The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. I'm on a telephone because I'm on the road, cannot always get to a place in a motel where I can set up my portable unit, and sometimes just have to broadcast from wherever I can. And so hopefully you'll be able to hear the program fine. Today, we're going to give you the latest on health and healing, a little more comprehensive information on Coenzyme Q10 from Kurt Sampson, also natural approaches to estrogen replacement. I think a lot of people find that interesting. I also want to look at natural eye care. And again, these are a little more comprehensive answers. And nutritionist Tisha Johnson did a nice little piece on seaweed I thought would be worthwhile sharing with you. So we have all that on health and nutrition and healing. Then my guest will be Stephen Cohn, and he is one of the nation's leading advocates for corporate and government whistleblowers, and has a long record spanning 25 years of court victories on behalf of individuals bringing the truth to the public about corruption, fraud, and misdemeanors. He is the executive director of the National Whistleblower Center and a trustee of the National Whistleblowers Legal Defense Education Fund. We're going to talk about honesty without fear. And that's important. He's also starting a brand new whistleblower program for all the whistleblowers in the United States and Canada. They now have a home every week on Progressive Radio Network. Now, for those of you who were able to listen last evening, because once a week on Monday evenings at 7 p.m. on the Progressive Commentary Hour, I do something that takes more time, attention, and scholarship than the normal course of a program, because in the course of a program, you want to do it in segments. Health and nutrition, healing, environmental issues, conversations with remarkable mind guests, social issues that are relevant to all of us, and then feedback from the audience on commentaries. So normally a program is broken into about six segments, and my hope is that at least one or two of those six people will find useful, and sometimes they'll enjoy all of them. But anyhow, I'm trying to provide something for everyone that has substance. But then I have an issue that requires undivided attention on it, like 9/11, the truth behind the official report. And that has taken 11 hours, and we did that on that commentary hour. Last evening I did what you heard was an hour, but it ended up being an hour and 47-minute report that you really need to listen to and you need to read. The full report with all the scientific references are on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, GaryKnoll.com, and my Facebook page. And it's all about the truth of the safety of vaccines, because almost 90% of Americans assume that vaccines are safe and effective. In fact, so sacred is this trust that it's not even questioned. Anytime anyone approaches anyone in the media with a story that there could be a problem with a vaccine, an individual vaccine or the MMR vaccines, the measles, mumps, rubella, or the DPT vaccine, we're told, well, we contacted the FDA or the CDC or the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease that handles vaccines, and they said there's no problem with safety. And there's no problem. Once in a great while, someone will have a minor adverse effect, not to worry. And that's where it's left. Now, try climbing that hill. And each step on climbing that hill, which is all sand, and then every step someone puts another 50-pound weight on your back. That's how challenging it is for a parent who has seen a completely normal child meeting all of their developmental standards, get their vaccines, and regress into some bad state. So I simply ask four basic questions. That's all, four questions. And I had to find the answers within Orthodox medicine's own science. Are vaccines safe? If so, what's the proof? Are they effective? If so, what's the proof? Are they not safe? What is the proof? Are they not effective? What is the proof? And that has required almost 2 years of full-time, in-depth scholarship. In fact, I have people in my office in New York. That's all they do, all day. These are PhDs, medical doctors. They do research. They're not advocates on any side. They're not pro or anti-vaccine. They're not pro or anti-AIDS. They're not pro or anti-fluoride. They simply look for the truth, and then that's where they align. And that's how I hire them. They have to give me irrefutable evidence, and then I have to do the work and write it and present it and then verify it. So this is quite simply the most definitive article ever written in the United States that I'm aware of, proving beyond a shadow of a doubt that not a single vaccine ever invented that is in use was proven safe for any given individual. To the contrary, when you start seeing the evidence that is unfolding, and in the 47 minutes you did not hear, I went ahead and continued recording just so we have it in our archives, I was able to prove that more people, mainly children, will die from the hepatitis A vaccine, from the vaccine they will die, than will die from hepatitis A. In fact, I used the CDC's own statistics that in a 10-year period, there were 5 deaths from the vaccine, 0 deaths from hepatitis A. Now think of that for a moment. Not only were there deaths, but there were permanent injuries, including seizures, brain damage, brain swelling, heart attacks in infants and young children. Hundreds and hundreds of adverse effects. Now, those are the effects that are actually officially recorded. Here's what the former commissioner of the FDA said, Dr. Kessler. Only 1 in 28 adverse effects are ever recorded. 1 in 28. So does that mean we could have had 28 times more deaths? Or 28 times more, for example, 24,000 times 28 with the Gardasil vaccine? In fact, they've lied completely, and I showed last evening the lies about Gardasil. There are 16 different human papillomaviruses that can all cause cervical cancer. Gardasil only deals with 2. Did they also tell you that most people who develop human papillomavirus can develop it on their skin, not just the vagina? But we were led to believe that it's sexually transmitted. Only one of the ways, skin to skin. We also can show now that even the developer of the vaccine has questioned and challenged how it's been promoted. And so now we're seeing that they gave live human papilloma DNA virus to people. That means that there's a high probability that the people getting the vaccine will get the virus from the vaccine. But they lied about it. They tried to quietly, after stating there was no way you could get the DNA and live virus in a vaccine that was actually in their package insert, they quietly withdrew that from their literature as if nobody was paying attention. So I've went through all of these, where individually the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine do not have the same negative effect as when you take it all together. And by the way, this is very, very, very important. As you know, a doctor that appeared on our program, Dr. Andrew Wakefield, and the debate that I had with the investigative journalist out of England, Deer, that he was the one who caused the excoriation of Andrew Wakefield, the loss of his medical license in the United Kingdom, and him being called a fraud. None of that was true. He was only one of 13 members of an investigative team who were considered the brightest, best in the world at what they did, examining the intestines of children who had had the MMR vaccine and manifested symptoms of specific inflammation. Some of those symptoms, some of those kids also manifested autism spectrum disorder conditions. He wasn't even the lead researcher, and yet he was the one singled out. Last evening, I gave the reason why they had to attack and destroy him. This is the first time you've heard it. We had to wait until all of our own investigation was completed. Once you hear why they went after him, what was he actually on to, and what could have happened had the public accepted the findings that these children who were completely normal prior to getting the MMR vaccine, I was able to determine that the vaccine that they were given had a specific virus in it that was causing this, and they knew about it for years. And they tried to hide this, and they changed the name of the vaccine. Wakefield didn't know any of this. None of them knew this when they did their work. They didn't know what kind of enormous problem they had uncovered for the British government and the vaccine manufacturers. Had they not destroyed Andrew Wakefield's reputation, taken away his medical license, the British government would have paid penalties close to $500 billion, bankrupted the government and the manufacturer as well. This would have set back the powers that be and their vaccine scheduling in England for a long time. Wakefield and his buddies didn't know any of this. We have all that facts in detail. Dates, times, bad lot numbers, the cover-up, and how the vaccine that ultimately was said to be not the vaccine causing problems, yeah, that's correct, because they changed it. The public didn't even know. And those 12 children that the journalist Deer and the British media said were not the problem, that's correct. They got the wrong children. The 8 children who were diagnosed and did have the problem were not the ones that they were reporting on. I mean, there's so many problems with how they went about this investigation. Once you hear the facts, once you read the facts, you'll think, oh my goodness, how could this have happened? They destroyed these people's reputation. They covered up a major crime against humanity. The British government, typical, the sleazebags that they are, the Tony Blair, the complete corrupt people, they buried great reputations so they could allow the vaccine makers and the people that supported them in their parliament and their vaccine advisory panel to skate free on this one. Well, now, as of today, the truth is out. That was in the last half hour of my presentation last evening. So when I tell you to go and download this, this is a very, very important. Now, I realize there are those in this audience who don't care about facts, don't care about the truth, because their mind is made up. Vaccines are safe and effective, in which case, fine. Go ahead and take all the vaccines you want. It's your right. But it is not your right to tell anyone else that vaccines are safe and effective unless you're willing to take full legal responsibility for your decisions. Because we have proven unequivocally, absolutely, that the entire field of vaccination, with no exception, is one massive public health fraud. And I will challenge anyone to come on this show, Paul Offit, any of the pro-vaccine people, and we will show you the millions of dollars that are given by the vaccine companies. We will show you the political deals made with ALEC and the support of indemnifying the vaccine manufacturers. We have a lot of ammunition to go after these people, but read this report. This was definitive, and there will be 2 more reports following this. The next one will be on the actual ingredients in vaccines. Last night was just on the safety, and you thought that taking a vaccine, minimal effects, you have no idea how serious those side effects are. You have no idea the tens of millions of people who are now adversely affected because they trusted their doctor. Big mistake. Or their nurse, or the people who are there. And where do you see the information I uncovered about who should not be getting a vaccine? By their acknowledgement, people who should not receive a vaccine, and what you should be told before you get the vaccine. Did you know there's a whole lot of literature that they're supposed to tell you and show you? Do you have a cold? Do you have the flu? Are you pregnant? Do you have any kind of immune-compromising illness? Do you have cancer and all these other diseases? Then you're not supposed to get a vaccine. Since when did anyone get denied a vaccine in the United States because of any underlying pre-existing medical condition? And as a result, everything that the government can do, it's done wrong. This is one of those cases where not only is the government bureaucracy corrupt, but deadly. So that's unfortunate. Anyhow, go to progressiveradionetwork.com, go to the archives, and download what could be an absolutely life-saving investigative report. And for lawyers, public health advocates, those in the vaccine community, you've never seen an article like this. This is not someone's opinion like Dr. Blalock or Sherry Tenpenny. This is hard scholarship science. Anything I do can be used in a court of law and withstand any forensic cross-examination. So let the lawsuits begin, and let the exposés begin, and let's get the whistleblowers coming forward, and let's get all the damaged and injured children and adults standing up and demanding the truth. We have the facts. Now we simply need to make it an issue. And we will continue on. This is one of 14 major public health issues that we are advancing. We're also advancing the cause for homeless vets, for the homeless in America, for closing nuclear power plants, stopping gas hydrofracking, genetic engineering our food, the FDA from stopping our freedom of choice over supplements, the USDA in banning or outlawing organic food by making rules, including their safety laws, that have nothing to do with safety, that have to do with everything, but a small organic farmer could never afford to go through. So that was last night. Now let's go to the latest on health and healing. And first and foremost, for those of you who take zinc, you're doing the right thing, because according to the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, zinc is protective for lowering your risk of dying from cancer of the prostate. Researchers evaluated 525 men enrolled in a case study in Sweden, and they were diagnosed with prostate cancer between 1989 and 94. And what they found was that over the 6.4-year average follow-up period, those who died had the lowest zinc intake. Those who lived and did not have relapses had the highest intake. And it says that there was a 36% lower risk of dying from prostate cancer if you took high zinc levels. And for those whose tumors were localized, there was a 76% lower risk of death. So, good news. Zinc protects you. How about helping a mood? Low intake of the omega-3 fatty acids has long been linked with psychiatric disturbances, though the exact mechanism has been unknown. Now a group of French scientists have discovered that dietary deficiencies of the omega-3 fatty acids causes a loss of function in certain central nervous system receptors that are crucial for neurotransmission and a healthy mood. So they're saying, take your omega-3 fatty acids, because if you're deficient, you can end up with mood disorders like depression. And also, a study associates vitamin E with increased lifespan, and this is published in the peer-reviewed journal Age and Aging, and it describes vitamin E on 10,837 participants in the alpha-tocopherol beta-carotene cancer prevention study, and they found that the more vitamin E taken, the less chance of dying and the longer life you could expect. Also, for those of you who are getting your heart surgery, here's something from hospital practice. Loyola University Health Study neurologists reported in a recent issue that neurological complications like seizures and strokes account for, quote, considerable death and morbidity following cardiac procedures. Delirium, pituitary gland problems, spinal cord and peripheral nerve injuries, and central nervous system infections are all issues. quote, neurologic complications are always a risk with cardiac surgery, especially in older patients who have health problems. But now they're showing that it's very serious. So just be aware that before they wouldn't tell you because they didn't know, you can end up with strokes and seizures from heart surgeries. Now they know it. And finally on this, a woman who has belly fat, you're putting yourself at risk for osteoporosis. There was a major study at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital, and they found that women who have a fat belly have bone mineral density deficiencies. So if you have a body fat index of over 30, you're at risk of osteoporosis. So get the body fat down, and I'm hopeful that many people will do that. Now, on the subject of coenzyme Q10, I've been advocating it for a long time, at least 25 years, and just hundreds and hundreds of studies have confirmed the safety and effectiveness of coenzyme Q10 for a wide range of neurological and aging and heart conditions. And yet the average physician in the United States and the FDA simply refuse to recognize all of the good work that's been done out there. So if you wait for them to tell you, good, go ahead and take it, you've waited too long. Ubiquinone, commonly referred to as coenzyme Q10, was originally named because of its omnipresence in virtually every cell of the human body. It was discovered by Dr. Carl Folkers, who was a pioneer in the fermentation synthesis, and he felt that it should be properly renamed Q10 and thus take its rightful place in the pantheon of essential nutrients. Now, two main theories have been set forth as to how coenzyme Q10 assists in achieving optimal health and rejuvenation from illness. First is its ability to increase the amount of energy available to those parts of the body whose cells most required, including the heart, the brain, the kidneys, and the skeletal muscles. And second, many of the benefits derived from coenzyme Q10 are thought to be the result of its potent antioxidant effect, as it scavenges dangerous free radicals, oxygen species that normally harm the body. So now what do we know? We know that, according to an article in the Journal of Nutritional and Environmental Medicine, a Dr. Singh and a Dr. Kumar report the results of a very well-designed trial showing coenzyme Q10 has a powerful role in adjunctive therapy in patients with end-stage kidney disease, in some cases even reducing or averting the need for dialysis. In a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial, the researchers found Q10 treatment decreased progression and reversed renal dysfunction in a majority of the patients with end-stage disease, many of whom were able to discontinue dialysis after the course of a 12-week trial. The report followed on a pilot study the scientists published in 2000 involving a smaller number of subjects. Now keep in mind, end-stage kidney disease produced marked organ contraction and progressive dysfunction with corresponding increase in levels of serum creatinine and blood urea nitrogen. And these are toxic waste byproducts that accumulate in the blood because the kidneys can't clear them from the body. But coenzyme Q10 came to the rescue here. So I would definitely consider anyone who has a problem with their kidneys and needing dialysis to look to see all the good research that's being done on this. But it also helps the heart. I believe every athlete, I believe anyone even going out to power walk, jog, bike, go to a gym should always take 100 to 300 milligrams of coenzyme Q10 because it reduces chronic inflammation of the arteries and the heart muscles, resulting in cardiac myopathy. In addition, studies by Japanese and Australian researchers, as well as by scientists in the U.S. and elsewhere, have consistently shown that supplements of coenzyme Q10 are effective against congestive heart failure and in preventing secondary cardiac events like after a person suffered an initial heart attack. Now, you can read this in Molecular Cell Biology, and it'll show you double-blind placebo-controlled studies. They're using 120 milligrams per day. I would suggest that three times a day. and for people with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, much higher. I'm also aware many people use statins because they're advertised on television, but statins are not the answer. Q10 deficiency in muscle cell mitochondria results in poor cellular respiration, and oxidative mechanisms and endothelial cell inflammation are recognized as important factors in coronary heart disease and atherosclerosis. And evidence shows Q10's supplementation can improve the circulatory process and prevent such irreversible and often fatal conditions like cardiomyopathy, congestive heart failure, and muscle wasting induced by statin drug toxicity. And since their introduction, the reductase drugs of statins have, I believe, been oversold. It's a $1 billion business, but statins destroy coenzyme Q10. So it's just quite simply, it's a superstar nutrient. I've seen it help with muscular dystrophy. Very, very good, because Q10 has shown significant less cytogenic and DNA damage than their untreated counterparts when they're using coenzyme Q10. There was research done by Dr. Lucia Migliori and colleagues at the Pisa University in Italy, and they compared basal levels of nuclear DNA damage as measured by chromosomal and DNA alterations, leukocytes, in patients. And they started using coenzyme Q10 and saw substantially less. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Mutagenesis. And also with cancer, several interesting studies were reported on Q10's effects against certain types of cancer, and studying differences between malignant and non-malignant prostate cancer. Dr. Jose Quilis and colleagues, University of Granada in Spain, found that malignant cells responded very differently to coenzyme Q10. They slowed down the whole process. So you want that, but mostly it's for the brain. There's been Columbia University College physicians and surgeon in New York found the coenzyme Q10 deficiency in the brains of 17 patients with ataxia and atrophy, suggesting an ataxic syndrome responsive to therapy. So coenzyme Q10, very important there. Macular degeneration, Parkinson's, they all are benefited by coenzyme Q10. So that's our nutrient of the day, giving it a little more in-depth there. And also, if this person is listening, Roger, who met me at the airport on Friday when I was flying out, came over and said he listened to the show. He says he's got a problem with acid reflux, and what might be able to help him. He also has allergies. And so I said, all right, which one do you are more interested in? He says, well, I'm only going to do one. I said, choose it. He said, how about allergies? And I said, are you willing to do a whole protocol? He said, no. He said, if there's one thing you could recommend, okay, for anyone who is limited in their budget or simply don't like to do a whole lot of protocol, if you have allergies, then try the natural relief and misery of allergies using a simple substance that will help nasal congestion, sneezing, inflammation of the eyes, and the misery that many people suffer from. It is called rosmarinic acid, R-O-S-M-A-R-I-N-I-C. It's an all-natural alternative to the painful allergy shots or pills that provide only partially relief from allergic symptoms. Rosmarinic acid, which is a plant polyphenol, is derived from the rosemary leaf, provides effective temporary relief of allergy symptoms. But unlike antihistamines, rosmarinic acid both prevents the activation of immune responder cells and kills excess allergy-activated immune cells. And if you want to get it extra potent, then use the perilla leaf extract, P-E-R-I-L-L-A. And perilla leaf enriches the rosmarinic acid, and so you get a 1-2 combination. Throw in a little quercetin, maybe 3 or 4,000 milligrams, and I would say maybe 100 to 150 milligrams from the rosemary leaf, the rosmarinic acid, and perilla leaf extract maybe 50 to 75 milligrams. So that addresses that problem. Trying to hit on several of the issues that people find important, and I'll be doing more in-depth studies coming up. But we're halfway into the show now. And, oh, by the way, before we go to our break and our topic of the day, this is from the newest press release from Borowitz. It says, announcing that it would completely withdraw its troops from Iraq by the end of the year, President Barack Obama today maintained that the United States was not deserting Iraq completely, as we would follow up on Twitter. Mr. Obama indicated the United States' relationship with Iraq would soon end its military one, but it would continue by social networking. You know, that's a good idea. Can't be all wrong about that. Now to our issue of the day. And because I'm outside of a computer or don't have one where I'm at, I'll give this insight and then ask you to call in and share your points of view. So here is our commentary from Roderick Tremblay. He is a professor and from Global Research. The decline of the United States of America, the moral, political, and economic causes. It's short, but I think very important. Here's what he says. The American economy is in the doldrums. The American political system is dysfunctional and paralyzed. Around the world, many are baffled by what's happening to the United States. It seems that all at once, the wheels are going off the cart. The American economy is in the doldrums, the American political system is dysfunctional and paralyzed, and a series of elective, faraway foreign wars is ruining the country. The U.S. economy used to be an engine for economic growth, and the American political system used to be a well-oiled checks and balances machine that was geared towards progress, and that could accomplish so much without constant compromising. Moreover, Americans can be proud that their Constitution, at least on paper, is one of the best in the world, having been crafted by enlightened founders who believed in individual and democratic freedom. The first cause of our problems is a moral one. It is related to the widespread corruption that permeates many institutions and sectors of U.S. society, the most corrupt of them all being the political system and the corporate system. It is no accident that the epicenter where these two corrupt systems meet is at the Pentagon, an agency that reports upon reports. It's just a cesspool of corruption. The result of that widespread corruption is that the United States is now generating a substandard class of politicians to administer its affairs who are not the servants of the common good, but who rather serve happily the narrow money interests that finance them. The U.S. corporate elite, for the most part, has abandoned all loyalty to its country while it roams the world in order to make short-term profits at all costs and avoid paying taxes in its country of origin. The result, wacky politicians and greedy business people are in charge. The same can be said about the biased corporate media, who have also abandoned all pretenses of neutrality and objectivity in informing the people and have rather donned the mantle of unadulterated propaganda in order to cynically manipulate information and public opinion to the delight of their money masters. Things were never perfect in the past, but I would argue that the current level and scope of corruption in the United States society is unprecedented and is a root cause of the decline of the United States. The second cause of American decline is more structural and more economic in nature. It is related to a widespread ignorance of the practical consequences of economic and financial globalization that began under the Nixon administration from 1969 to 73, and which accelerated under the Republican administration of Ronald Reagan, 1981 to 89, and George W. Bush, 89 to 93, but then under Bill Clinton as well. I shall tackle each of these causes separately. First, the U.S. has abandoned its democratic ideals and the quality of its politicians is substandard. Let's talk first about the moral and political causes of America's decline. British Prime Minister Winston Churchill once quipped that democracy is the worst form of government except for all the others. Indeed, democracy is a very fragile political system that can sometimes fail the very people it was designed to serve. American President Abraham Lincoln defined it as a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. But democracy is at its worst when an oligarchy takes control of a country's institutions and imposes its agenda, such is the case with today's United States. Money interests, not the sovereign people, control the political system today. They control the corporate media system. They control the U.S. Supreme Court and much of the judicial system. And I would argue they control a large chunk of the academic system. The results are everywhere to be seen. The United States has reached levels of inequality and wealth and income that used to be seen only in some backward third world countries. Another form of political corruption and intellectual decay is the widespread refusal nowadays to abide by Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution. Indeed, Article 6 expressly stipulates that, quote, no religious text shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. This would seem to me to be clear enough. Some 50 years ago, in 1960, Senator John F. Kennedy was elected President of the United States, stating that his religious beliefs were his own personal affair and that, as an elected official for all the people, he was going to use his best judgment in his public decisions and not be obligated to follow the dictates of any established religion, not even his own, the Roman Catholic Church, nor of its Pope. As an indication of how much the United States has regressed from the question of separation of church and state, consider that a presidential candidate of the quality of Senator John Kennedy will most likely not be elected to office today with such a stand of intellectual independence. Mind you, most of the fathers of the United States Constitution could not be elected today, a clear indication that the United States has strayed away from its founding principles. Consider what President James Madison had to say about religion and politics. Quote, the number, the industry, and the morality of the priesthood and the devotion of the people have been manifestly increased by the total separation of the church from the state. Unquote. Do you really believe that President Madison could be elected today? Nowadays, in fact, religious zealots dominate the Republican Party, while some half of Democrats think that a presidential candidate must have, quote, strong religious beliefs to be considered for public office. The only problem is that such a view is in direct conflict with what the Constitution says. Mixing personal official religion with democratic politics is a form of intellectual corruption. It's dynamite. If the United States continues in the same destructive direction that many theocratic Muslim countries have followed for centuries with disastrous results, I would not hesitate to predict that the U.S. will self-destruct. But point two, the widespread confusion between what works in an open economy as compared with a closed economy. Let's talk economics. The U.S. economy, like most industrial economies, is an open economy. That means that goods and services can be exported and imported while facing a minimum of border taxes and other barriers to international trade. For a quarter of a century now, it has also meant that the U.S. economy, in part of the economic globalization model, the latter goes much further than free trade. It means that corporations and banks can move their capital, technology, and productive plants around the world in search of the greatest profit and the best investment environment. I happen to believe that this globalization model has been pushed too far and has become a major cause of economic stagnation in industrial economies. When it comes to economic policies, what can work in a closed economy does not necessarily work in an open economy. Consider macroeconomic policies to stimulate the stagnant economy. In an open economy, Keynesian-type stimulus policies of deficit government spending or of a tax reduction do not work properly, essentially because stimulus policies of this type are the equivalent of heating a house in the winter with the windows and doors wide open. The new deficit spending may help the world economy, since much of the new spending ends up abroad. But the domestic multiplier effect of such spending can be very low. This means that such an economic stimulus in an open economy may not be as effective in stimulating economic activity as hoped, and in some circumstances it can do more harm than good. Nevertheless, many politicians and some economists cling to the old idea that lowering taxes for the rich when the government is in a deficit or new non-infrastructure government deficit spending can stimulate the economy. This obviously does not work, at least not if the new deficit spending is not focused domestically. Spending deficit money in Afghanistan or Iraq doesn't do anything to stimulate the U.S. economy. What works in an open economy are policies geared towards changing relative prices in order to encourage domestic production and employment. First of all, a lowering of the real exchange rate can encourage net exports and stimulate domestic production and employment, provided the government does not sustain excessive domestic absorption through unproductive large deficits. Another final approach to skew relative prices in favor of domestic production and employment is to use the tax system accordingly. Presently, many American corporations are hardly taxed at all on their profits when they operate abroad. Some appropriate taxation of these profits can encourage the repatriation of capital and support additional domestic investment. So those are his thoughts. I'd like to hear yours. Give us a call, 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Nall. We're here to hear what you have to say, and we'll be back in a moment with your thoughts and our guests. Please stay with us. Welcome you back. I'm Gary Nall. In a moment, we're going to go over to our guest and speak with Stephen Kahn concerning honesty without fear in the world. Recently, I was in Washington, D.C., demonstrating outside of the White House and helping support several different movements simultaneously. And while there, I had someone from Washington who is a part of the permanent bureaucracy, a volunteer to help with our camera crew, because we were literally picking up all of our equipment and walking from one block to another, because it just so happens there were all these demonstrations on different blocks. And I asked him, I said, what do all these people do in these buildings down here? And he just laughed, and he said, well, Gary, he said, the reality of Washington, D.C. is that 80% of all the jobs in Washington, D.C. downtown here, these are all people who learned how to milk the system. They get the taxpayers, in one way or another, to support them. But they didn't do anything that improves the quality of life for the average American. These are people who learn how to game the system. The lobbyists, the consultants, the foundations, they're all self-serving. And none of them make it a better world. But once they get established, they just keep going on and on and on. And they build bigger offices, and then they spread, and they grow like a cancer. But the average person is just not aware of it. Okay. Glad to know that from a Washington insider. Before we go to our guest, let's say hello to Ellie from New Jersey. Hi, Ellie. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Gary. Thanks for taking my call. I listen to you guys every day, and I'm a nursing student, and I know all about the nutrition supplements, and this just makes me so happy that you every day give us free lectures on this radio. It's nothing better, and people who really don't agree with you are just ignorant. They just ignore reality. I don't know what to say. I just say thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate you calling in and sharing your thoughts with us.
I appreciate all your thoughts about nutrition and politics. I think you are very smart. I know all your books, and I was just listening yesterday to what you said about Steve Jobs, about the transplant, liver transplant. And today we had a lecture in nursing school about liver transplant and what the requirements are. And one of them said you cannot have cancer if you're a candidate to actually get a liver transplant. And I just said, wow, kudos to him. He just does the homework. And I just get a lot of information from you, as just for me and other listeners who don't really have the time to sit in front of the computer and listen to or read tons of articles. You are just giving us a free truth lecture. What better can you get?
Well, let's just go. Thank you for that, Ellie. Let's just go for a second over to this issue. 60 Minutes, unfortunately, in this case, because sometimes they do very good reporting, and I appreciate when they do. And they did offer a forum the very first time on network television that a alternative cancer therapy was actually defended and the politics behind it exposed. It was my article on Dr. Lawrence Burton. That was on 60 Minutes back in the 70s. But today, on the subject of vaccines, they don't do their homework. On genetic engineering, they're not doing their homework. On AIDS and AIDS drugs causing the number one cause of death, and all the foundations and the $800 billion that's made on AIDS, no one's doing their homework except for 3,200 scientists, doctors, and journalists who did, and they're then pushing away from the official story. And for years, organic food was denigrated. Now it's shown that organic food is better than genetic engineering, actually gives better harvest yields. So we can feed more people with organic than we can with genetic engineering. So all their arguments are moot points. But when it comes to Steve Jobs, here was the issue. The issue was simple. They said that if Steve Jobs had gotten the surgery earlier, then he would have lived longer. A, as you just said, one is contraindicated to the other. Liver transplant when you have cancer is not indicated. He knew that. B, I looked up the actual National Cancer Institute's data on morbidity and mortality for each cancer and the American Cancer Society statistics on morbidity and mortality for each cancer. First, we found out that over 647,000 people died of cancer, all using just official therapies. Why didn't anyone say, we killed 500,000 people last year using our therapies, but we're not going to take any blame and we're not going to change anything? That's number one. At an average of $200,000 per patient. Secondly, Steve Jobs lived 9 years. The average life expectancy for his stage of pancreatic cancer, maximum, is 20 months. But more realistically, it was 16 months. So he outlived his contemporaries who had the same cancer by 300%. Why don't you focus on that? But they chose to look at this from their point of view, and the person who controls the argument controls the mindset and propaganda. But thank you very much, Ellie. I appreciate you calling in, sharing your positive thoughts. I'm Gary Noll. Let's go over and say hello now to Steve. Is it Cohen or Khan?
Gary, Stephen Cohn, like an ice cream cone.
Oh, Cohn, okay. Stephen is beginning a new program, and it's going to be called Honesty Without Fear. And Stephen is the executive director of the National Whistleblower Center in Washington, D.C., and a trustee of the National Whistleblowers Legal Defense Fund and Education Fund. He's testified in Congress. He's counseled the Senate Judiciary to protect whistleblowers, and he's the author of the first legal treatise on whistleblowers back in 1985, and he's since published many other things. And so your program is on Tuesdays at 1, and it's time, of course, that we started having a regular weekly show so that all the whistleblowers know that there's a place where they can share their information, get their word out, and help others. What do you see are some of the most important issues today that whistleblowers have that are not getting out, the major media are not covering?
Well, the major point in whistleblowing today is the fact that employee whistleblowers are the number one source of information on fraud, misconduct, and violations of law. This has been studied by statistical agencies and government surveys, and it shows that if you want to find fraud, you need employees who witness it and can come forward. These studies show that 98% of the people who witness fraud and misconduct never report it to an appropriate authority. They never go outside of their company and blow the whistle.
Why?
Of those 2%, many of them go to agencies that are apathetic or in bed with the industry. So the bottom line is if someone's committing a fraud, they will go undetected. And essentially, fraud does pay, because those who are in a position to identify it are afraid of being fired, losing their jobs and careers. And it's a crisis here in America.
Let's just use some of the examples that have been reported through your organization recently. Give us some updates. For example, I just received, I'm on the road, but I received this message last night that that the United States military paid $1.1 trillion, that's with a T, trillion, to contractors that had defrauded the government, meaning the taxpayer. And the amount of money that they had given to people after they had been found guilty of fraud, like Raytheon, they got $1.8 billion in a contract after they were committing fraud. Lockheed Martin, $30.2 billion. In contracts after they committed fraud. 54 other companies got $255 million after committing fraud. So here we've got companies that have lied, deceived, manipulated, and have been found guilty of that, and yet they're still getting money. They're still in line with their hands out, and much of this work in the military-industrial complex is redundant. We don't need it. It is not helping us make it safe. But it's causing an awful lot of people to have social services cut. So we have unlimited trillions of dollars for the military-industrial spy complex to take us away from our freedoms and choices, and also to deprive us of our right of habeas corpus that the left seems to have completely abrogated its responsibility on, in Congress at least, not those who are the historical liberal Democrats. They're outraged by these aggressive acts of war and also spying on people. But the contractors are the ones who are feeding at the trough. Why aren't the whistleblowers coming out and exposing these people? And so we can stop it, or could we stop it, even if we knew the truth? Or is it too perfect a crime where no matter what you do, if you're in the military-industrial complex, you're given absolute indemnification. You can do any damn thing you want to anyone you want and any time you want. And if you're an official, you have the power to destroy anyone who stands in your way. Those are my thoughts. What are yours?
Okay. I think, first off, I see hope. I have seen the power of a whistleblower to change institutions, to hold even the most powerful people accountable. I have seen it with my own two eyes. I've had the honor of representing whistleblowers who have made real change, positive change, in the public interest. Because of that, I am frustrated by the retaliation and chilling effect, by the fact that at least 98% of the people who witness these frauds are afraid to come forward. That's what you're seeing, Gary. You're seeing the results of the chilling effect, the results of when people have been fired and then their coworkers are afraid. Also the results of Congress's failure to protect whistleblowers, to enact strong laws. So you see that in the results, because the bottom line is frauds are designed to be secretive. No one is marching up and down the street saying, hey, I'm ripping off the taxpayer. They're designed to be secretive. But in a modern industrial society like we live in, employees will learn about these frauds. And the key is to get them to step forward. They need protection. They need strong laws. They absolutely need public support. That's one of the reasons we're doing this radio show, is to get support for these American heroes. But the bottom line is clear, and I think, Gary, you're the witness to this. Without the whistleblowers, without the insiders with the actual information demonstrating the corruption, they're going to get away with it. We're going to get ripped off. There's going to be abuses. People will die. We've seen that. But I'm here to also bring a message of hope, because I've actually seen individual whistleblowers stand up against some of the most powerful entities in this country and win. One of them will be in our show later this afternoon, Fred Whitehurst, who individually took on the FBI and forced major changes out of that institution against all odds.
Are you aware, thank you for that, Stephen. Are you aware that there's a whistleblower inside the military-industrial complex that told Sarah Lazar that sexual assault and rape is virtually epidemic, and that one in three female soldiers are raped during their military service? That is a scandal beyond scandal. Everyone should be outraged about that, left and right. There's no excuse. There's no one I know that would say, yeah, rape in the military is a good thing. They should hold every single person accountable for that. What do you want to bet that not a single person is held accountable for the massive epidemic rape and the abuse of women in the armed services? That pisses me off. And I would fire the President of the United States in a heartbeat, because he's the one who has to make the choices, Commander-in-Chief, of who gets prosecuted and at what level, and as we know, it never, like Abu Ghraib, it never reaches the top. Your thoughts,
you know,
please.
Yeah, and one, and what
Let
we would like
this.
To do with the
so
honesty
you can hear
without
directly from the woman. Quote. Hold on 1 second, Stephen. This is a quote.
Sure.
My experience reporting military sexual assault was worse than the actual assault, says Jessica, a former Marine officer and Iraq veteran who left the military because of her command's poor handling of her assault charges. Quote, the command has so much power over a victim of sexual assault, they are your judge, jury, executioner, and mayor. They own the law. As I saw in my case, they are able to crush you for reporting the assault. All right? So that's just one example, but this is a person reporting on behalf of many. But nothing about it. We don't have the whistleblowers. We don't have this as headline news.
Well, one of the things I'd like to do with Honesty Without Fear, and we will do, is give a forum to these whistleblowers, either anonymously or they can use their name, to give them a safe harbor where they can come forward, speak to the American people, speak truth to power, and rally support. This person, I did read this story, and I was also impressed with her courage. This is the beginning of what you might see in a whistleblower movement. One person with the courage to expose it, to step forward. Will it lead to others? Can we give her support? Will the public rally behind her? These are the issues that can make an exposure, one report of abuse, and turn it into a movement that can actually create positive change. And the Honesty Without Fear program, that's our goal. We're saying we're not just talk radio. We're action radio. Whistleblowers need support, period. They need the public to stand behind them. Whistleblowing is a very individual thing, and often you're in hostile territory. You're exposing a company, and your coworkers are afraid of losing their job. Or you're reporting in the military with a chain of command that hates dissent, and you're stepping out usually individually. These whistleblowers need public support. And again, I've represented whistleblowers for 28 years, and I have seen the impact of public support, how it does create change, how it does protect these heroes.
Well, I'm 100% behind you on this. And we will give our full legal support. We have over 20 leading activist lawyers who will be there also as a part of this. I hope that at some point you will be able to have some whistleblowers on the 9/11 issue come forward and to properly and accurately deconstruct the official version. And all it takes is one of them to come out of the woodwork and for that whole case to unravel so we find out at least the truth of what is not true about the report, which now is being challenged by thousands of experts in different fields. And I also hope at some point someone within the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, a very corrupt organization that represents the industry but not the public, has the courage to come forward to show us how much influence, how much money, what favors are done between the nuclear power people and the government to keep them pro-nuclear. The same would be true for the oil industry, the gas hydrofracking. We all know that gas hydrofracking is extraordinarily dangerous, and yet we haven't had anyone in the industry come forward to blow the whistle. We also know that that we have to get a handle on biofuels. It's been misrepresented by what it does. It's a major polluter. It's not economic, and yet we're taking food that should be grown and distributed to people in the United States and around the world to feed them, instead it's going for these biofuels. So in all these areas, all we need are whistleblowers to open that door, vaccines in particular. So we're going to be listening in on Tuesday to your show, Honesty Without Fear, a place for all whistleblowers to come and know that they can have a forum and say their mind with confidence and with a whole lot of people backing them up.
Thank you so much, Gary.
Stephen Cohn, thank you for your good work. We look forward, and I'll be letting people know about your show on Tuesday just before you come on the air, all right?
Thank you.
And you'll have Mushu Kaku, Helen Collicott, Danny Schechter. You'll have Jim Hightower, a whole bunch of people who are on Progressive Radio there to give you support and the whistleblower support. And all of these people know whistleblowers, so you will have a ton of guests.
Well, again, thank you for this opportunity. We need to rally the support, and I think this show and working with Progressive Network is critical to changing the attitudes of every American and make sure we have widespread public support for the world.
Hey, if we didn't have the whistleblower in the tobacco industry, there still would not have been a lawsuit won by tobacco smokers, and the tobacco industry would be getting away with addicting people. All the best. That is Stephen Cohn. I'm Gary Knoll. That brings us up to the end of our program. For those of you who are listening to our local land-based station, we'll continue for the next 2 hours. For those who are listening just over Progressive Radio, we will say goodbye, and we have a whole lot of good programming for the rest of this week. For those of you who live in Los Angeles or want to hear the overnight show, our sister station, WKPFK in Los Angeles, for 28 years, every week, 6 hours, midnight to 6 West Coast, 3 to 9 East Coast, I'll be doing a special program, as I will later tonight. Have a good day, everyone.
Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tavenfeld.